I certainly am really pleased that we're moving to a more proactive approach to well-being and mental health, that we've moved quite significantly away from just fixing it at crisis point, reactive. I think that's taken a big cultural shift, but it is really, really well done to all the staff, the faculty, the students who've campaigned, everybody who's worked to make sure that we have well-being conversations just as part of everyday life, that we can ask people how they are and check in with them.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Education Empowered. I'm your host, Jason Belland, Vice President of Education Cloud Industry Solutions here at Salesforce. Super grateful to have this opportunity to connect with all of you again. Thank you so, so much for taking the time to be with us. I'm really excited about today's episode, you know, because last season we took some time and last season we were recording really in the height of the pandemic where so many of us were pivoting on a daily basis, or so it seemed, to understand how we can better serve our students, our faculty, our staff, our institutions. And we really spent a lot of time talking about student and faculty well-being. It's important that we keep that conversation going. And today we're going to revisit that discussion with a new guest who's offering a different perspective. So joining me today is the amazing Dominique Thompson. She's an award-winning UK general practitioner, young people's mental health expert. She's an author. She's an educator. She's done a lot of different roles. Over 20 years of clinical experience caring for students, including as a police and expedition doctor, and most recently as director of service at the University of Bristol Students Health Service. She was named Bristol Healthcare Professional of the Year 2017, and in 2019, she was nominated as one of the top 100 West Women of the Year. If that is not impressive enough, Dominique has also helped design apps and websites to support student mental health. That's something that's of interest, I know, to all of us, and she's written books on the topic. Today, she's going to talk to us about student well-being and mental health and what institutions, what schools and faculty can do to better support student wellness. And I will say first, Dominique, welcome to the show. And I watched your TED Talk, one of your TED Talks earlier this morning, and I'm just delighted to have a chance to speak with you. So thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, Jason. That's a really kind introduction.
Dominique, I hope one day I am on a podcast where I have such a great, like somebody here can say all these nice things. you're so accomplished, and it's so wonderful to just be able to spend this time with you today and really talk about, you know, this topic that has you know, been on our minds in higher education for quite some time, but really came to the fore over the last year and a half, rightfully so, and is continuing now as a topic that college presidents and beyond are thinking about and really putting the right kind of energy behind. So I'm excited to dig into this with you. I'd love to maybe we can kind of back up for a minute here and just kind of talk about how it all began for you.
How far back do I go?
Yeah.
I used to carry, when I was 5, a little like nurse's outfit case around with me. So I guess we could say I've been on this path for quite a long time.
Oh my goodness. I would like to start there. That sounds amazing. That's a good visual for all of us. And so it's wonderful to have you with us. You amazing CV that we kind of touched on here. But how did you get started in thinking about well-being and student mental health?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's a pretty niche area, or it certainly was until a few years ago, being really interested in young people's mental health and students in particular. And it came about really because I decided to do general practice. So in the UK, I'd done my medical studies, and then I did a bit of training after that in the hospitals and so on. And then I did a couple of other things that were a bit left field. I went off on an expedition, and I decided that, you know, I wanted to do something for a few months working with an organization called Rally International. And you go with young people who are just out of school, really out of sort of 18 plus. And we went off overseas, and I was looking after them in, you know, quite challenging environment of the Malaysian rainforest. And then I came back and started doing interesting things like family planning clinics. I was a police doctor for about 18 months, 2 years, but only specializing in young people's sexual assaults and rape. So I had specifically seemed to subconsciously pick lots of interesting areas to sort of subspecialize in that were young people's health. So someone pointed this out to me and I said, oh, maybe I should look at doing young people's medicine. I mean, it wasn't really a thing 20 years ago, but that's how I ended up starting to work at Bristol University as a GP. So on campus every day, all day, looking after students. And gradually over that time, I became really interested in mental health. I would say both through necessity and interest, in fact, because the numbers of people coming in with a mental health problem were going up and up and up over the time I was a GP there. And that takes us to about 4 years ago, when I sort of, as we may go on to talk about, but I took a sidestep and left clinical practice to focus on, should we say, more strategic approaches to the mental health issues that I was seeing.
And let's transition into that. I'd love to hear about sort of the work you're doing and a little bit more about Buzz Consulting.
Oh, sure. I mean, essentially, I wanted to deal with all these mental health problems, but perhaps not in just a one-to-one every 10 minutes as it is in the UK for an appointment.
Sure.
You know, I felt like I was helping people, but perhaps I felt maybe I could offer something in a different way. So I thought, well, what about if I, you know, start to work with institutions, the colleges, the universities themselves, and offer my insights or, you know, strategic thoughts about how to approach the problems that we were seeing? What about if I wrote some books? And so that was another way to get the message out to young people, because you know what it's like when you do a job, you sort of find yourself saying the same things perhaps over and over again, not in a bad way. It's just that every other person coming in needs the same help. So you think maybe there's a more efficient way to, you know, get the message out there. So I started creating content, videos. I did the TEDx talks. So it was really, Buzz is a sort of broad approach to trying to help young people and the people who work with them. So parents, teachers, staff in universities, with supporting their mental health. And that's what I do, all of those things, in particular, lots and lots of talks. Now I give lots and lots of talks, you know, in schools and to university staff and so on.
That's amazing. And really just reminds me, I think I had a very different subject matter, but similar journey in my work joining Salesforce, actually, where I was doing a lot of work within institutions and then really had this moment where I thought, how do I scale my impact? How do I do something larger and take what I know and make sure I can bring that to all universities globally? So
yeah,
that your story really resonates with me. And I think with so many of us who are doing work in the field and thinking about how, you know, we're all impact driven and how can we do more in the world? It's exciting that you went down sort of the path of writing a book as well. I'd love to kind of maybe take a second on that. I think many of us have maybe thought about writing a book or thought, oh, I really should, you know, I should do that because that could be really exciting. I could help get my story out. Going from thinking about doing that to actually doing it is probably a journey that you have to take and sitting down and doing the work. How was that for you?
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? Because people always say, everyone's got a book inside them. And I always visualize mine as being like Jason Bourne or really exciting. I never ever thought it would be a parenting book and then a whole series of little books for students on mental health. And you know, people sort of laugh when I say I've written a book all about parenting and stuff, just because that wasn't ever my drive. My drive was always the mental health of the young people and helping the young people. But I kind of, when I finally had time to think about it and took a step back after about a year of having left clinical practice, I realized that the people who needed to hear this the most, what's happening, why it's happening, what are your young people saying when they sit in that room with me in confidence? Obviously, nothing I say is not, you know, I'm not breaking confidentiality, but I'm giving them back some of that information. I thought it's the parents, it's the carers, it's the teachers. They need to know what's happening and you know, what the sort of the themes are, if you like, of what we're hearing. So it sounds funny because, you know, I don't consider myself like a parenting expert, inverted commas, but I do hope that what I write about in my book, How to Grow a Grown-Up, is useful to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I love that. That's great. And let's talk about the causes and sort of the what's the why of what's happening here. You know, from our Connected Student Report, which we just released recently, one of the data points we had there, and it's a global report looking at universities around the world, talking to faculty and staff and students. 76% of students, 73% of staff talk about well-being being a challenge for them and having to maintain their well-being. And I think that number really does resonate with us in so many ways. What's behind that? What are you seeing in terms of the causes of some of these challenges? And maybe I'm interested in hearing sort of what are some of the factors outside of the classroom that are playing a role in how students feel at school?
I mean, this is such an important topic because, you know, we can all sort of sit and read these reports and feel, you know, really quite, in my case, sort of shocked and worried about the fact that three out of every four people around us in that campus environment is feeling that level of stress and inability to manage their mental health and well-being. So I always think it's really important to get underneath that and find out what's going on, and kind of spent quite a lot of time over the last two or three years investigating that, looking at the research, seeing what had been done. And that was what fueled my TEDx talk, the one that's called What I Learned from 78,000 Consultations with University Students, and also some of the books and the talks, is that there are actually some things that have radically changed over the last two to three decades, really. So it isn't just that young people these days are talking about their mental health more. I mean, they are, and that's fine, but that's not what's going on. And it isn't, and this really does annoy me when I hear perhaps older people say, well, they just can't cope with their stress, or, you know, that there's something fundamentally wrong with them, like there's a deficit there. That really gets up my nose if I'm allowed to say that. So basically, I thought, okay, it's not that. I know it's not that. So what is it? What's going on? And that's where it gets really interesting. And that's where I've sort of dug out some of these fascinating studies, like the one that shows the rise in perfectionism in young people over the last 30 years. So there's this amazing review that was done, and it looked at over 40,000 students in the US, Canada, the UK, and it looked at them over that whole period of time, 30 years, and it looked at their perfectionistic traits. So how perfectionistic are our young generation now compared with 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago? And the answer is much more perfectionistic. And a lot of people sort of think, well, does that matter? I mean, doesn't it just mean they'll tidy their room or they'll write a better essay? But the problem is, it's not that that's the problem. It's the toxic perfectionism, the sort where they're highly self-critical, they undermine themselves, they're never happy with what they've done. And they, you know, they'll get, I don't know, 95% in a test, and they worry endlessly about that last 5%. It's that sort of self-critical perfectionism, and also the sort where they worry all the time that they're not good enough in other people's eyes. So they worry about letting people down and that fear of failure. That is one of the things that has changed the most over the last two or three decades and has had an impact. And I tell you why it's had an impact. It's because perfectionism is strongly associated with mental health conditions. So anxiety, depression, self-harm, obsessive-compulsive disorder, eating disorders, compulsive behavior, compulsive exercise, they are all associated with high perfectionistic traits. And that is not good for the whole generation. And we can, if you want, talk a bit about why that might be, because it's kind of a weird thing to happen, but it's certainly one of the things that's happened. And people always say to me, what about social media and things like that? And of course, it plays a part. Of course, it's a big change, but it's not the only thing. And what it does is it magnifies that comparison culture, that competitive culture, that need to be the best and, you know, get high scores all the time.
Yeah, that totally resonates. And I'd like to understand sort of how you're coaching institutions to kind of care for students and to help address this. And, you know, one of the things we found from our report was that about a third of students felt that institutions should or could play a role in supporting them in their well-being by offering more opportunities to feel engaged, maybe less isolated, access to mental health experts. And, you know, students are really saying that, you know, there is a role for the institution to play. Technology plays a role in this as well, in terms of making sure they're getting that kind of personalized engagement and alerts or text messages or those kinds of things. I'd love to just maybe holistically understand, you know, when you're working with institutions, what is the role for an institution to play in thinking holistically about the student experience and their well-being?
Sure. Well, one of the main things that's so important that is starting to happen a lot more here in the UK, and I believe has been happening for a while in the US, but is that institutions are moving away from that mentality of we're just here to provide the academic experience,
sure,
that we're just here to, you know, give them a degree, essentially. So the holistic approach, or in the UK, we talk around the whole university approach, which means that it becomes everybody's role to look after each other, to create a compassionate campus, to think about what impacts people's mental health and well-being at different points. So it might be during the academic year, there might be specific touch points that you want to review. It might be processes that are incredibly labyrinthine or complicated. It might be something, I say relatively simple, but is hugely impactful. For example, if you're going to ask a student to leave your institution, don't do it by a letter that they get in the post with no one to support them around it, which in the past is exactly what would have happened and still does in some places. So it's looking at the whole way that the institution can help. Just to tie it back, for example, just another sort of smaller example, but the perfectionism side of things that has definitely impacted young people's mental health, the biggest fear they have now is this fear of failure, but also staff, faculty, they also are in this environment where they really are afraid of getting things wrong and failing. If we tackle that, first of all, by talking about it, but also there are two ways to go about this. One, don't make everything a competition. Let there be bits of life that are just for fun, just for trying stuff, where it doesn't matter if you get it wrong. So that's important. Otherwise, people just don't try anymore. They don't give stuff a go. And I always tell people, you know, it's so important to try new things, but we have a generation who are terrified of looking bad and getting it wrong. So they don't try new things. And when I give them my example, I say, you know, I tried paddleboarding last summer. I think it's fair to say I probably won't be doing that again. Me and my center of gravity were not made for paddleboarding. But the point is, I gave it a go and God, did I feel good afterwards. Mm-hmm. I felt like, wow, I've tried that and I feel amazing. And my self-esteem was boosted. So we have to still encourage them to try new things where it doesn't matter if they get it wrong. So there's a lot around, you know, creating a culture where it's okay to fail or to get stuff wrong or to learn about new things without that fear that goes around it.
Yeah, and I'd love any examples you can share of someone who's, maybe we could leave the name of the school out of it if that's not appropriate, but someone who's doing that well. And I'm curious about just the different sort of players on campus, the different staff members, who needs to come together and have a kind of the meeting around the conference table or the Zoom call or whatever and say, we need to do things differently here. We need to change and it needs to be a cross-functional effort.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, certainly even just 10 years ago, probably anything to do with mental health or well-being was immediately, it was like things were covered in, I don't know, do you know Teflon, where it just glides off, right?
Sure, yeah.
You know, it would be off the Teflon of the vice chancellor or the principal's desk straight onto the director of well-being or support.
Sure.
And we need to stop that. Actually, it needs to be part of everybody's remit to consider, not have to fix it all, but to consider mental health and well-being in their day-to-day job.
Yes.
And so if you're head of, I don't know, exam planning and timetables, have a think about how the timetabling might impact young people and your staff's mental health.
Yeah.
You know, is there something that could be done differently? If you are considering it at a much broader level with all those different departments looking at mental health and well-being as part of their role, part of their, you know, broader job description, then it becomes important that the mental health and well-being people, so the support teams, accommodation, meet with academic faculty, the sports teams. And then not forgetting, you know, obviously I mentioned accommodation, really important. But then, you know, the people at the more senior strategic level who have traditionally perhaps focused more on money, retention, degrees, you know, who's kind of the business side of it. Mm-hmm. You know, they all have to understand and recognize that without the mental health and well-being of your staff and students, you're not going to get the best results elsewhere.
And I love that we're thinking about this and discussing this idea that well-being and wellness really is, if you will, kind of should be applied horizontally across use cases, across departmental silos, and really needs to persist across the entire student experience. It reminded me of an episode, I can't remember what season it was, but a previous episode on this podcast, where I had a conversation with a wonderful woman, executive, who recalled her college experience. And talked about her first day at college and her whole family. She was a first generation college student. Her whole family drove with her in like a couple of cars. They all took the drive to bring her to college for the first day. And they showed up to her dorm to get her set up. And they realized when they showed up that they had bought the wrong size sheets for the bed. And not really a big deal. Like, you can, that's something that one can change. But she talked about that moment as like signaling that this maybe college wasn't for her. Like, there was already like things that seemed to not acknowledge that no one in her family knew anything about college or the right size sheets to buy or the right, or how to, you know, sign up for classes or get these. So it seemed like there's a lot of small signals she was seeing at that time that were saying, this maybe isn't for me. And do I fit in here? Will I connect with other people here? And so this notion that well-being persists well outside the classroom across all of these experiences and belonging across all these experiences really, I think, is critical here. And probably equally as critical is saying it's not one size fits all well-being, but how do we think about these different, you know, personas or individuals who are on different life paths, an adult learner, an 18-year-old coming in and thinking about what might wellness look like for them. I'm curious if you can just maybe help us think about how we should, you know, think about these different journeys, that it's not just kind of a one-size-fits-all approach.
No, and I think that that is something that people are acknowledging perhaps more and more as the students are invited more to feed into and co-produce, whether it's the resources that are provided to them, the peer support that is out there when they arrive. They're often paired up with a previous student or someone who's in an older year. You know, students are being involved more and more in the development of services, in interviewing new staff. You know, as it's part of that whole university and that holistic approach. So the more that we involve the students, the more we'll understand what that means for different groups of students within it, you know, to provide a less one-size-fits-all, you know, university experience. And I think, you know, as we have seen, certainly in the UK, and I'm sure this is the same overseas as well, more and more young people going to university. I mean, huge increase in numbers over the last, you know, 50 years in terms of numbers of people going to college or university. That brings fantastic opportunities for education, but also significant challenges in terms of you have a much broader range of people. So you have people coming who would never have come before. Yep. Everything from physical disabilities they might not have come with, mental health problems, you know, they just wouldn't perhaps have come in the past, through to the, you know, the cultural thing of, well, our family doesn't go to university. You know, there's all sorts of ways. Mm-hmm. But the good thing is, I guess, and I say this as somebody who has seen thousands of students over a long period of time, is that you're not alone if you feel like that, because actually there are so many young people now coming from, and older people, that's, as you said, coming back to university is becoming much more, you know, acceptable. There's less stigma about it. So the great thing about coming to, you know, a campus or a college or university is that you'll meet other people who are like-minded. They might not be like you, and you may not even like the same things, but you will find things in common. You will connect. Mm-hmm. And meeting other people, connecting with other people, and creating that sort of social network around you is the number one most important thing that all of us can do for our well-being. So we're humans, we need other humans.
Yeah, I love that. That's great. And I'd love to talk about, and by the way, disappointed that you said overseas instead of across the pond. I was really hoping for a...
I could have said that. I was trying to be really inclusive, though.
More global. Okay, really, it's really global. Everybody. Okay. I was, as you were going into that sentence, I was waiting for across the pond, and then I didn't get it.
Oh, will she, won't she?
We have more time here, so we can...
Oh, disappointing.
I'd love to talk about sort of the end of the student journey. That's a highly stressful moment for many who maybe are not sure what they want to do, or they're sure what they want to do, but are having a stressful moment thinking about what does the next step look like? Where are they going to go? What's the first job? A lot of expectations there, maybe from family or even personally. How should institutions be thinking through that moment? Someone said to me the other day, the transitions are our greatest problem, like the onboarding of students and then sort of students to becoming alumni or going to career, all of these moments, or students to then a grad program. All of these transitions are where we really struggle to create kind of bridges for students and the real opportunities to help. So maybe talk a little bit about that transition period and how we can better support well-being.
Yeah, absolutely. Transitions are stressful, and that's That's almost biological, because as humans, we don't really like change. I mean, there are a few crazy people out there who just love the adrenaline, but most of us, we don't feel very comfortable with change. We like things to be predictable. And that's a very basic survival mechanism. It goes back to, you know, millions of years ago. So it's entirely normal, if you like, that transitions, you know, into university and college, out of it, and all the years in between are going to be stress points. So I think we have to acknowledge that and not try to say we'll make them stress-free. I think that's unrealistic, because in life there will always be changes, and the point is you have to have the skills to deal with the change. Mm-hmm. So the first thing is to be upfront about it and say, we know this is going to be, you know, a potential challenge. You're going to need to deal with new things, but we'll help you with that. So that's the first sort of message. In terms of, if we're talking about just at the moment, transitioning out of your course, you've graduated, you're going out into the big wide world or onto another degree, what we know is sadly from the past, in the sort of 1980s, when there's been a recession before, and there may well be this recession at the moment impacting students, is that there are things that we can do to help students who graduate in a recession, because sadly, we know that graduating in a recession isn't good for your health and well-being. Mm-hmm. It actually has quite long-term effects if we don't do anything about it. So there are things that the institutions can do to mitigate that, you know, long-term impact and the shorter-term impact. And there are three things in particular that institutions can focus on. I would say that number one is still building that social network. And it's never more important than when you're going out into the job, you know, market. The more people you know, it's not just about that someone to talk to if the job interview goes wrong, but actually the more people you know, the more you hear about internships and opportunities and other careers.
Sure.
So that's really important. Anything that institutions can do to connect students with other people, any other people, but just other people. And then the next thing is careers advice. Careers advice is super specialized. It's not my area, but it is one of the things that has been shown to be really, really important and helpful. So really tell the students, this has been shown to be helpful. It's so important that you connect into our career services. And if possible, continue the careers support beyond the front door, as it were, when they're out there. Maybe give them, you know, a year of extra support if that can be done.
Yeah, I love that.
You know, that's something that would be really impactful. And the final thing is financial education. Traditionally, students are not necessarily, you know, very well educated about finance, and yet it's one of their biggest stresses, you know, alongside relationships. I mean, academic stress is number one for students, but after that, you've got your relationship stresses, you know, living with flatmates and other people. You've got all the stuff to do with, you know, any family stuff going on back home, and then money. Money plays a big part. So I think if we can, and again, this is one of the things that's been shown to be helpful, give them a good financial education. It doesn't have to be long and in depth, but some basic financial skills so that they're not struggling with debt that they didn't understand, or taking on more credit than they can pay back, or understanding the difference between good and bad debt even. You know, there are things that can be done that would be relatively straightforward that would help and give them some life skills going forwards, which are particularly helpful and help their mental health.
I love that. And I particularly, you know, love the idea, this kind of focus on the career services office. Another conversation we had a couple episodes ago was really talked about how that office is changing from the, I think earlier this year, I was cleaning out my closet and saw from my undergrad a pamphlet from career services that was like a checklist of things I need to do like before graduating. And that was basically my only engagement with the career office was this pamphlet. So that was a long time ago, but you know, things have evolved. But actually some of the great conversations we've had with customers and, you know, leading institutions has been, you know, people saying to me, you know, actually career services should not be the final stop on your way out the door. This should be, again, integrated horizontally across. So we're having these conversations as your career changes, as you unexpectedly discover a career you didn't even know existed, but actually plays your interests and strengths. And how can we actually facilitate this journey of discovery and unexpected connections along the way and not in a panic 2 weeks before you graduate or something. So love what you're saying there. I also love just talking about some things that we can do as individuals, but you talked about not kind of avoiding stress or trying to run away from stress, but and this reminded me of my morning meditation of, you know, acknowledging the stress, acknowledging the problem, and for what it is and not kind of having that kind of upend my entire life, but kind of, you know, appreciating it for exactly what it is and nothing more or less. And I think that's so important that we don't try to kind of do things to avoid these challenging conversations or stressful moments, but rather kind of understand the skills, like you said, how to navigate and manage that. All of us, I think all of us, maybe 99.9% of us, I'll leave some room, have been dealing with a lot of challenges over the last year and a half. And we probably have some time to go before we're back to normal, in quotes, whatever that means. You know, I was like stuck at home with family at this point. It's, it was a delight for the first 2 weeks. And now we're stuck at home. You know, it's, you know, there's home challenges, family, illness challenges. I mean, there's just a lot, financial challenges. And then just the fatigue of Zoom calls and everything else that's going on and seeing the same four walls every day. How do you, you know, so the well-being and then there's, you know, the headlines, I think probably on a weekly basis now, the great, what is it called? Resignation wave of people rethinking and maybe in a healthy way, thinking about what's my next career step look like? And how do I want to be living my life? How do I want to be presenting myself at work and using my time? How can we as individuals think about, or how should we be thinking about well-being as well? What are some of the lessons that we can take as, you know, people in our own relationships, but also professionally as we're working with students and making sure that, you know, I think acknowledging probably in order to help students, I have to also help myself and be in a good place emotionally to be able to do the good work that I want to do and make the impact. So that was a really long intro to a question and I apologize. maybe I'm a little stressed out and need to talk to you separately, but I'll leave that with you.
Oh, no, that's fine. Yeah, I think, well, there are a lot of things there. And actually, I think it made me think of a couple of things. So there are things that we can all do in that you're right. We need to look after ourselves. And this has shown us it has never been more important to, mm-hmm. you know, make sure that we have time to get outside, you know, be active, make sure we get our sleep, you know, those sorts of things, which are absolutely crucial for everybody's day-to-day well-being. So those are, you know, kind of your baseline starter points. But in terms of supporting students, young people, but also ourselves, you know, if we are staff or faculty, one of the things that we can do to help the next generation coming through is not just focus on their academic education, but the life skills they need to deal with ups and downs, because we have never had more ups and downs in a short space of time than in the last 18 months. Mm-hmm. So I used to give the talk that I give to sort of what we would call them sixth formers, the sort of final year at school before they go off to college or uni, about being ready for life after school and, you know, what those life skills are. And it, you know, people think, well, but you're a doctor, you know, shouldn't you just be talking about medical stuff? But actually what I saw so much of the young people sitting in the chair in front of me was that they were coming up against problems, transitions, changes and challenges in their day-to-day life. And they didn't necessarily yet have the skills, which is fair enough in many cases, to deal with them in a sort of non too stressful way. Mm-hmm. So it was always a crisis or it was overwhelming, you know, this feeling of, so sure, they could ask their family and their parents to step in and their carers, but actually they needed to learn to deal with those independently. And it might be something like how to have a difficult conversation with a flatmate or how to have a conversation with your supervisor, you know, the member of staff who you feel is being unfair. Or those things are enormously stressful, you know, all day, every day, you're kind of mulling them over and it then, obviously, the reason I was seeing them is it might be acted out in ways of impacting on their sleep and their mood and their anxiety or self-harm or eating issues. You know, so when you dug underneath the problem, you came to something that I would call one of those, you know, challenges in life that we have to learn the skills to deal with. So you sort of hinted there right at the beginning of your question about what can we do and how do we deal with some of those difficult things? And I think it's a question of learning about those as we go along, taking the opportunities when they arise. So if you're an academic member of staff and the person comes to see you and it's not actually, I mean, they haven't handed in their essay, but actually, what's the reason? What's gone on there? Well, actually, you know, my flatmate is doing this, you know, all night she's playing loud music or she's slamming doors or whatever.
Sure.
You know, it might sound like, well, that's just normal stuff. Actually, it's incredibly stressful. You're sleep deprived. You're also not getting your, you know, your deadlines.
Sure. Yeah.
So perhaps it's not that the academic has to sort the problem out for them, but just talk to them about it. Talk to them potentially about, well, okay, if you're going to have a difficult conversation, pick a quiet moment. Don't pick a moment in the middle of the stress. Be ready to compromise. Consider the fact there might be something going on for her, you know, and we kind of know those things because we're older, but, you know, they're learning as they go along. So I'm a big fan of actually helping those young people understand as they come through those life skills, as well as how to look after their, you know, mental health more directly with the sleep and the activity and the getting outdoors.
Yes.
Because if we don't help them with that, we're just going to keep seeing the same problems. I mean, that's what some of my little books are about, my little guidebooks for students, which are, you know, about resourcefulness or resilience, if you want to call it that, about, you know, staying well at university, because it isn't just about the physical exercise and stuff like that.
Yeah, no, I love that. And I just read, I'm looking at my bookshelf, which is just beyond my laptop. I can't find the book I'm scanning, but I just read a book recently regarding difficult conversations.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, actually, one tip that was interesting for me that helped, I really struggle with that. I'm very conflict averse. So
yeah, fair enough.
As many people probably are. No one's like into conflict probably, but I found it useful. This is sort of a thing for me, at least, like helps me with these conversations is, kind of naming that we're having, like, okay, Dominique, like, I need to have a challenging conversation with you. Like, we need, so just like, okay, I'm framing.
Exactly.
This is the space we need to be in here. And it's for me, kind of has invited then a conversation. So that's the only tip I can offer to the audience. That's it.
It's a good place to start.
But yeah, let's start there. Okay. I don't have enough for a book on that. That's my, that's it.
It's a t-shirt right there.
Exactly. That's awesome. Okay, so Dominique, it's been great talking with you.
Thank you.
And I just love just all the inspiration you've offered us that I think we can apply as professionals working with students, as we're thinking about how to create, just be more intentional across the student experience. I love that well-being doesn't exist in one office. It needs to exist across experiences.
Absolutely.
To create this holistic engagement that helps a student on their path as a student and then beyond that. And hopefully they'll re-engage with the university in lots of different ways, be a mentor and all sorts of different ways to continue to help other students. Maybe I'd love to just end on just getting maybe not to put too much pressure on you with the ending statement, but a word or two of inspiration in terms of maybe some of the trends that have you excited about the future we're creating together as educators.
I certainly am really pleased that we're moving to a more proactive approach to well-being and mental health, that we've moved quite significantly away from just fixing it at crisis point, reactive. You know, I think that's taken a big cultural shift, but it is really, really well done to all the staff, the faculty, the students who've campaigned, everybody who's worked to make sure that we have well-being conversations just as part of everyday life, that we can ask people how they are and check in with them, and people are slowly reducing the stigma. Of course, it's still out there, but, you know, slowly we're breaking that down. And I think that move to a more proactive approach is fantastic. I think potentially in the future we'll actually go, I mean, I don't know if it's happening yet, but as far as when students arrive at university, I would think something like them having their own well-being coach alongside, you know, the academic side of the support.
I love that.
I mean, in some ways, some of that's happening through perhaps the mental health advisors and so on, but that is more specialized. It's not everybody. So I think there will probably be that kind of move that not just peer support, but the peers will be, or the mentors will be, you know, well-being coaches that will help everybody. And then it gets passed on down. So I think that's probably the sort of direction it's going in, that well-being, mental health become normalized as part of the everyday experience on campus.
I love that. Dominique, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. It was so great to hear from you. Thank you for the inspiration. I know it was super valuable for all of our listeners. So really appreciate it. And hopefully we'll be able to talk to you again sometime soon.
Thank you so much. I'd love that. Thank you.
Yeah. And to everyone listening, thank you so much. It's so great to be with you today. And we will see you on the next episode. Take care and be well.
Thanks for tuning into another episode of Education Empowered. If you enjoy this episode and want to explore these topics in greater detail, be sure to check out the second edition of Salesforce's Connected Student Report. The survey includes insights from more than 2,000 students and staff across 10 countries about students and staff well-being, career readiness, flexible learning options, and so much more. You can find the report at sfdc.co/connectedstudentreport. That's sfdc.co/connectedstudentreport.